Now is the chance to use reliable energy to grow your money with the Dominion Energy Reliability Investment. Our new investment product offers competitive returns, no maintenance fees, and flexible online access to your money. Make the reliable investment in reliable energy. The Dominion Energy Reliability Investment. To find out more, go online to reliabilityinvestment.com. That's reliabilityinvestment.com.
The only thing better than grinding all night for your side hustle is your roommate picking you up with Mickey D's breakfast. The perfect pickup deal.
There's a deal for every morning at McDonald's.
Right now, taste breakfast perfection when you get a warm and savory sausage McMuffin with egg for just $2.50. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with combo meal.
Look, staying healthy isn't easy. Watching your diet, hitting the gym, avoiding stress. But a good night's rest helps boost your overall health and wellness. And it couldn't be easier. The Sleep Number 360 smart bed effortlessly adjusts in response to both of you. The result? You wake up ready for anything. Proven quality sleep is life-changing sleep. Don't miss our weekend special. Save up to $1,000 on Sleep Number 360 smart beds. Plus special financing. Ends Monday. Special financing subject to credit approval. Minimum monthly payments required. See store for details.
Now is the chance to use reliable energy to grow your money with the Dominion Energy Reliability Investment. Our new investment product offers competitive returns, no maintenance fees, and flexible online access to your money. Make the reliable investment in reliable energy. The Dominion Energy Reliability Investment. To find out more, go online to reliabilityinvestment.com. That's reliabilityinvestment.com.
Hey everyone, it's Rosanna Arquette here, your guide for all radical musings. I want to quickly talk about dysfunction. You know, everyone has some sort of dysfunction in their life, right? I mean, I know I do. I mean, talk about dysfunctional. When does shit ever truly go according to plan? Sometimes we just have to look at the humor in our idiosyncrasies, right? I mean, Hello Dysfunction, as in the podcast. Hello Dysfunction. Yup, this series is hosted by two childhood best friends, Pata Fria and Crystal, as they share personal stories of their own dysfunction. Nothing is off limits and everything is funny. They talk about their lives, their view on the news, gossip, politics. This is really good stuff. Check out Hello Dysfunction on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Radical Musings. I couldn't be more excited or honored to have this next guest on my show, Ruchira Gupta. Ruchira Gupta is a journalist and an activist. She's the founder of APNE App, a non-governmental organization that works for women's rights and the eradication of sex trafficking in India and around the world. Her work has touched people on a global scale, and it's just awe-inspiring. I'm always so humbled to be in the presence of people who are truly making a difference. But I have to warn you, these aren't easy topics to cover. Sex trafficking is unfortunately so common and widespread and very profitable. This is my conversation with Ruchira Gupta. Hi, Ruchira.
Hello. Namaste. Good morning.
Good morning. You're back in New York and you have just been in India for a year. Tell me the state of what's going on in India right now, as we know, because the farmers and everything that's happening. And then we're going to get into, we're going to go backwards, maybe. Let's go what's happening right now in India and what you just witnessed. They took your passport away and all these things that happened. I'd love to talk about that.
India is going through its toughest periods, almost like an emergency suspension of civil rights. It feels like the onslaught of fascism, the creeping in of fascism. We have an authoritarian leader as our prime minister. His name is Modi. And since he has been re-elected 2 years ago, he has cracked down on journalists, attacked them, jailed them. He has also cracked down on any kind of protest which challenges his policy. This year, there's a big farmers' protest against a law that he wants to get passed in which basically he wants to cancel fair price for farmers and remove any kind of government protection and subsidies for the crop that farmers sell by letting farmers out into the open market. And farmers, millions and millions of farmers are sitting in protest across the country against this, because there will be nobody to protect them from the big retail chains if this happens. Most of them don't have any warehouses and storage facilities, so they will be forced to sell their crop to whoever buys it at the end of the day. Besides that, he's cracked down on women. He's cancelled inter-race marriage between Hindus and Muslims. It's called love jihad. So, you know, people are jailed, young people, if they date across religion. He's also arrested some students. A student I adore who was speaking up against the cancelling of government scholarships for poor students in colleges. And he's cracked down on women. Last year, a lot of women sat in protest across the country, hundreds and thousands. I spoke in 13 of those rallies. It was against an unfair citizenship act, which was going to marginalize Muslims and turn them into second-class citizens in India by taking away their right to citizenship, even if they were born in India. So, you know, we have had like a steady onslaught of the erosion of our rights. And I myself have been subjected to a lot of intimidation and harassment.
I'm so worried for you. I was really worried about you. We met many years ago. I mean, how many years ago now? Not many, but what is it? Seven?
At least.
Eight years ago? Yeah. Like that. Years. And I heard you speak, I think it was it Visionary Women or some place that you spoke about, the work that you do, which is, and I'd love you to explain it, but, to people who don't know this incredible work you do, which is helping, girls who are sold into sex slavery as children, help them get out and educate them and create a life and heal. And that, and in India especially, and you were actually the person, which I've always known about the trafficking, but actually opened my eyes to the fact that brothels and this happens here in America. It's here all the time. And it's maybe even more hidden here, but it exists, and it's a huge, huge business. It's the sex trafficking business, especially with children. Tell me how this came about and how you got into this work that is, you know, the most incredible humanitarian important work as far as I'm concerned.
You know, Rosanna, I used to be a journalist, and I was walking in the hills of Nepal looking at how villagers manage their natural resources. When I came across rows of villages which didn't have any girls from age 15 to 45, and I could not understand so many villages with missing girls. So, of course, I began to ask around, and the answer changed my life, because I found that a smooth supply chain existed from these remote villages in the Himalayas to the brothels of Bombay and Calcutta. Predators, traffickers would come into these places and speak to very isolated, ignorant, innocent farmers, offer them like a couple of hundred daughters and say, we will take your daughter to the big cities, and there she will have food and she will be able to send some money back home. We'll get her a job. The farmers didn't know better, and they would let the little girls go. And most often, you know, these girls were just between the ages of 9 and 13. They were very trusting. They were smuggled across the border and put into trains and buses and taken to the brothels of Bombay. And I followed this trail, and what I found in the brothels was little girls being raped by 10 men a night for 30 cents, 40 cents.
I mean, and it's like hell. This is hell. This is hell on earth, true hell on earth, that this exists. And it does exist, folks, out here in America too. But tell me, so then, Your life changed from, did you actually follow the traffickers to a brothel? Like, is that how you did it?
Yes. So, you know, then I decided that I would follow. And I found a young man who was the brother of a girl who disappeared, and he was interested in, he wanted to find his sister. So with his help, I went into the villages, I went to the border, I met the corrupt cops, went undercover, and ended up in the brothels of Bombay. And I vomited because I literally saw girls in cages, little girls like 10 years old on display for men. And as a journalist, I'd covered war, I'd covered famine, I'd covered hunger, I'd even covered some conflict. But this kind of intimate exploitation of one human being by another. And so I told the story. That's what a journalist can do. And I wanted to do more. But in that moment, I made a documentary called The Selling of Innocence. I won an Emmy for Outstanding Investigative Journalism. But yes, it felt not enough. I was in the Broadway Marquis Hotel, surrounded by people, job offers, glamour, the award in my hand. And I felt I could do anything. And I thought that that anything has to be something that I have to do for that last girl, the girl I met in the brothel who couldn't get away. So I went back with that award to Bombay, and I went to the women and I asked them, I said, I want to do something and you want to do something. That's why you broke your silence. So what can we do? And they said, save our daughters. They said, whatever has happened to us has happened, but we don't want our daughters to have the same destiny. And you have to just take a moment to imagine the room that I was talking in. It was a small 4x4 foot room, two beds tucked in, three maybe, and there were iron bars in the window, just one door to go in and out, and really tightly packed. The women had no cupboards, 20 rooms in a row in one long balcony with one toilet at the end, the sound of noise, vendors, music, customers coming. And in the middle of that, the women sat me down on that bed. And I sat on one bed. On the other bed, there was a customer with a woman, a sari separating the two beds. And it was stinking, you know, it was sweaty and hot, and there were rats on the floor.
Oh, God.
And the children were playing. Jesus. And Rosanna, the children were playing on the floor while another woman, their mother, was being raped on the bed next to us. So I could understand when the woman said, save our daughters. And, you know, we began.
How did you get in? How did they allow you to be able to sit there and do this interview? How were you safe doing that?
You know, that really was such a difficult negotiation. You know, I did not want to go inside the brothels with the help of the police or with the NGOs. That time there were no NGOs working there when I made my documentary. And I didn't want to use any muscle men. So there was a little tea store, very basic, just a wooden bench and some tables and tea being sold there. And I would just go and sit there every day waiting for some of the women to come and have a cup of tea. And I would strike up a conversation with them on feminism. And I, of course, did not look like them. So they would say, why are you here? And I would say, I want to tell your story. And they would say, why? And I would say, because as a woman, I do not like to see other women or girls being exploited. And, you know, one thing led to another and we built trust and they told their story to me. And, you know, there was a moment, Rosanna, where the women rescued me. I went inside the brothels. Yes. And I was filming.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, I've told you before. And, you know, I was filming and I had two very, in those days, you know, the cameras were bulky. It was a Betacam 800. And I had a big cameraman, a Sardar, and another guy. And the three of us went inside the brothels. And, you know, to go up the balcony, there was always just one narrow staircase and it was protected, you know, and guarded by pimps and muscle men and all of that. And as we were going up, he said that, you know, I'm not going to take my expensive equipment in there. It's too risky. And I don't know what's going to happen. And I sort of challenged him and I said, I'm half your size and I'm going up and you can definitely come with me. So we did go in there. And when I was filming, a man pulled out a knife at me and he held it at my throat and he said that I won't let you make this movie. And I literally didn't know if I was going to live or if I was going to die, or would I be scarred for life? I didn't know what his next move was. And I just looked around me at the women who were sitting around me in a circle telling me their stories. And these women came forward and they surrounded me and they told the man that if you want to kill her, you've got to kill us first. And he slunk away knowing it would be too much trouble to kill 23 women. And so they saved me by forming a circle around me. And they saved me before I saved them ever. And that's what I reminded them. When I went back with my ME, I said, remember the power of our collective circle? We formed a mandala. And can apne aap not be a mandala? And that's how the name apne aap was also born. Apne aap means self-action in Hindi. So we realize the power of the circle in our own actions. And we realize the power of the collective self-action. And we began. And, you know, it was just so empowering.
I know you're very close with Gloria Steinem. She's one of your best friends. Did the circle come of women come from inspired by her and her circle that she, or did she get that from, you know, that she does that too for yes. years?
Gloria got that from India, but not from me.
Yes.
She, as a young woman, was traveling in India with a group of Gandhian activists. And she was going village to village, trying to quell some caste riots, you know, some kind of, like you have race riots here, you know, there was a caste hierarchy and people were killing each other because of their religion and their caste. And Gloria,
can you explain the caste system? Can you explain that for people who may not understand what is the caste system and how it affects, you know, citizens of India?
In Hindu religion, there is a hierarchy based on occupation, and it is, you're born into it. And basically there are like 64,000 hierarchies. It is so stratified. And those who perform all the rituals in the temples are at the top of the hierarchy. Those who rule are at the top of the hierarchy. And that those groups are called castes. Those who are merchants belong to a different hierarchy. That's another caste. And inside being a merchant also, there are different layers, you know. So if you trade in rice, you will belong to a different caste from if you trade in oil. And this is how it is right to the bottom. If you work on the land, you will be somewhere very low. If you're a daily wage laborer or a farmer who works on the land, even lower in the hierarchy. If you work with leather, if you clean toilets, untouchable. So you're absolutely out of the hierarchy altogether. And even your shadow is considered polluting. And people will wash their utensils if you walk into their home or if you drink tea from a mug in their home, etc. So it is that bad. It's worse than apartheid and it's worse than racism because there is no escape if you're born into it and the society knows all around you. So that's caste. And
that's how the children, like girls who end up in brothels, have no way out.
In fact,
if it wasn't for you,
a lower caste there are certain castes who are supposed to be sexually available for upper castes, and the traffickers know this, so they go into caste communities which are dominated, which are oppressed, because they know that there are enough little girls who are poor female teenagers who belong to the dominated castes and nobody is going to watch out for them. If they are taken away, if they are stolen, if they are kidnapped, there's no police officer who's going to come and ask where they are. They'll say, oh, this is their destiny. They are meant to be pimps and prostitutes. And the upper caste groups also believe that this is their destiny. So they will do nothing about it. And they actually believe as the entitlement that these low-caste girls have to be available. And this translates into policy too, where the sexual exploitation is so normalized that I have had police officers tell me, oh, so you want the traffickers to be punished, the customers to be punished? How can you say that? Those are upper caste people. You know, they have a right to do this. Men will be men. And if girls, if poor girls from low-caste families are not exploited, then upper caste women, upper class women will be raped. So we have sexism, we have misogyny, we have casteism, And we have, of course, poverty. All of it gets mixed up, intersectionality, in the life of that little girl who's in a brothel.
So Modi, the president, how does he feel about what's going on in his country with young girls being sold? This is part of the system, so he's completely okay with it.
Poor low-caste girls are not even on Modi's radar. He thinks they're disposable people. And he tried to actually take away even the few basic rights they have twice through laws that he tried to enact. One was a law on child labor, in which he basically legalized child labor by introducing clauses into an existing law.
Oh, God.
He said that girls up to 15 years old can work, and it doesn't matter if they don't go to school or they can work after school. So he violated International Labor Organization standards and United Nations protocols to do that. And then 2 or 3 years ago, he tried to introduce a law to basically say that against trafficking, but he took away the words sexual exploitation from that law. So he wanted to say that there is no such thing as sex trafficking in law. We opposed that law and he wasn't able to push it through parliament. But he tried very hard to make sure that sex trafficking would not be considered human trafficking, again in violation of the UN protocol. Because remember, Modi comes from a group known as the RSS. RSS was founded in correspondence with Hitler and after a visit with Mussolini.
Third Reich.
Right, SS, right? And they've added an R before that. And basically, what the group is an all-male group. It's a paramilitary group. And the founder said that the reason he formed this group was he wanted to militarize Hinduism. He thought Hinduism was too passive and too sissy. So he invented a new term called Hindutva. And he said, I'm going to militarize this. And it's only going to be men. And they're all going to be taught to fight. And especially against anyone who's not part of the caste hierarchy. So Modi was groomed from age 8 in that group. So he believes that women should have a subjugated role in society. They are meant to be mothers, daughters, wives, reproduce and be caretakers of the house.
That's what's happening in America, starting slowly but surely, like this violent disease of fascism and misogyny coming in through the QAnon group and all this stuff that's happening that we just saw on January 6th. I mean, that's what's starting to happen here. Don't you feel that?
Absolutely. And I don't know if you know that, but the QAnon groups have infiltrated a lot of the yoga groups and the art.
Yes.
Saying that there's a new power in yoga, which is based on tantric stuff and which is based on the subjugation of women's bodies. And this comes from a fascist in Italy called Evola, who had written a book called The Power of Yoga. And so there's a huge infiltration where they use the naivete of the people in these groups who think they are basically checking out of society and mainstream life. And then they manipulate them towards fascism. And fascism, you have to remember, rests on two pillars. One is violence and the other is misogyny.
Yes.
And fascism eroticizes violence, and especially violence to women.
We're so anxious in the last few years, and there's just a little relief. It's funny because I had a talk last night with my friend Jane Fonda, who was, you know, worried that I'm getting too negative and that there's cause of celebration right now, that we really should get into the energy of the fact that Biden is doing good things and he's surprised us all by the things that he's moving forward, and for me not to be so down about it all, because I have been, not him, but just terrified about what you're talking about in your country, seeing slowly but surely are people really aware that this is happening here. It is. And we have to refuse fascism no matter what. It is slowly happening, and one day it could just be there, and then what?
Exactly, you know? Rosanna. You know, in India, people used to tell me, when I warn people that fascism is coming, they would say, oh, it can't happen in India. India is too big. Mm-hmm. We are too democratic. We are argumentative. Mm-hmm. We are too chaotic. And, you know, all of a sudden now, we are fighting for every inch of democratic space. Every day I wake up in the morning to hear about the arrest of some innocent person just because she or he has challenged the government. Yesterday, a young girl who's in her 20s was arrested because she made a toolkit on the farmers' protest inspired by Greta Thunberg. And she's in jail today. Every single day.
That was the environment. You mean just because she did something that was about the environment, which because the environment in India is horrendous, that they have no, they just throw everything in the river, and it's awful.
And the air is toxic nowadays. And,
yeah.
You know, Greenpeace has been kicked out of our country. Ford Foundation was kicked out and allowed to enter only on the, only if they checked in with the government for every grant they gave. Golden handcuff. Wow. And 50,000 NGOs have been shut down who do not agree with the fascist principles of the ruling party.
So what's happening with APNEA right now?
An NGO which works against sex trafficking. Mm-hmm. And what is controversial about that? Getting little girls from red light areas into schools and helping their mothers access food and other basic needs. That's what APNEA does in the red light areas. And suddenly, Modi's government sent us letters saying that I, the founder, have been practicing unconstitutional and anti-national activities by showing India in a poor light abroad. And what was that anti-national activity? I was making movies. I was amplifying the voices of survivors and talk at the UN, saying that they need more help. They need better laws and policies, and we have to get it to them. The anti-national activity I was doing was I was distributing food as part of a huge food drive that I've been running called 1 Million Meals during COVID.
Yes.
To get food to the victims of sex trafficking, just because the government failed to do so, because the government thinks these are disposable people. The stigma, the hierarchy, all that is part of fascism, right? That some people are better, some races are superior, some class of human beings deserve the food and others don't. And
how did you get out? Like, so they took your passport away. I was really worried about you. And then you also got COVID. And so, I mean, and here you are back in your home and you're a survivor on every level. And I'm so happy that you're okay. I was worried there for a minute. Like, are you going to be okay? Like you just, and I'm so glad you got out, but how did you get out? How did they let you out? How did they not arrest you?
So they did want to, and I've had several skirmishes. So first they tried to harass me by shutting me up by attacking my NGO. So they sent this letter to my NGO and they said they punished my NGO for my political beliefs, basically, by freezing two of our accounts. And we had two other accounts, which we are working through, but the two main accounts. So a lot of our money is lying locked up in a bank, which we could not use during the COVID crisis in India.
Oh, no.
The second thing they did was that when I went inside the country at the airport, they took away my passport saying it's damaged and gave me a little piece of paper to say you can go in and figure out what you're going to do. And they would have possibly done more, but I have been reading for the last 3 or 4 years books on fascism because I've had to deal with these people for about 25 years since I was nearly strangled to death by them when I was a reporter covering the demolition of an archaeological site by them. And I, I knew what to do. So day one, when I landed in India, there was a big event inside my NGO, Apne Aap, with the Queen of Sweden who was visiting the children. So we had a lot of press. We had foreign diplomats and all of that. That was the first thing which happened. The second thing was that I went and met the UN resident coordinator and briefed her that I was in the country and what was going on. The third thing I did was I flew to my own hometown, Calcutta, and got a new passport through people I knew and got some Schengen visa stamped on that and did two events with the American embassy and the French embassy there. Again, prominent events. And I also spoke to people I knew here before I went who had previously worked with me and knew me. So they had told people in the different embassies that I was coming into the country and to keep a watch on what was going on. And I filed a case against the Ministry of Interior in my country called the Home Ministry, which had sent this letter freezing my NGO's bank accounts. And they had actually interrogated the executive director of my organization by calling her to a stadium, and in some plain clothes men in this unknown stadium with their shirt buttons open had thought that she was me and tried to shake her down and terrify her. And when they realized that her name was different from mine, they asked her about where I was. They wanted to know where my parents were and all of that, basically to send a message to me. So I thought that instead of fighting in the shadows, I need to draw this out into the open. So whatever I have to do, it will be done transparently. And so I filed a case against the Union of India, against the government of India, saying that you cannot punish an NGO for the political beliefs of the founder. I hired good lawyers, and the case is still going on. And so far, the judge has been asking the lawyers, the government lawyers, to produce some evidence for punishing our NGO. And he has said that, he's told the government lawyers that they have gone beyond the ambit of the law by punishing an NGO before even investigation has begun. He's also told them to produce the evidence in a time-bound manner. So I have drawn them out of the shadows into the open. And now everything is part of a legal proceeding. So I think the international support of feminists and other networks I have, because Gloria Steinem also announced on a public program, a conversation that I did with her, with thousands of people watching in India, that everyone in America was looking out for me. He was looking out for me. And if anything happened to me, then people would be ashamed, attacked, and all of that. And she said that very openly, that I was not alone. So I think the international friendships I have, the fact that I went to, I took the matter into open court, and the media publicity and all of that that I did when I was in India, I think all of that sort of has kept the government at bay. But the fact is that I'm still being harassed. My NGO is still being harassed. The staff that I have are having to face off all this. And we are trying to do our work in spite of it all. But so many of my friends, their NGOs have closed down, and they've given boxes and boxes of documents to the government. And so many of them have charges against them, of sedition. So many fellow journalists have been booked by the police. They cannot leave the country. So it is a very dangerous and tricky time for India, and also for America and for democracy in general.
Yes.
So if we don't learn from each other, our destinies will be similar.
What do you think we have to do moving forward in America right now in this time, even though, by the grace of, that Biden is in, we still are dealing with this, fascism, half the country, and what do we do? Where do we go from here? We refuse it. We're organizing all of that. But what can we individually do?
I think the two main things I can speak based on what has happened in India, for now it seems in India we've lost the battle. We have an authoritarian leader who's changing laws and arresting people and taking over the country and has basically got into every government institution. So it's like a machinery we are up against, not a political party. And it's hard to recover lost ground. The mistakes that we made in India was that we did not hold accountable the people who were destroying all our institutions right in the beginning. And so we said, we don't want to hurt the sentiments of Hindus. When I was nearly strangled to death, when I was covering the demolition of a mosque, I remember I was belittled and humiliated in court. I was asked that, well, how can you speak about what happened to you? Journalists should not become the story. You should keep quiet and move on. This is what happens to a girl who's doing a man's job, etc., etc. And we never held those accountable. There was no discussion in parliament. The political party was not banned. And they just continued about their business. And they grew in that process by polarizing India. The second thing we did not do was that we never educated India about Islamophobia, because this political party was destroying a mosque and they were trying to polarize the country on Hindu-Muslim lines along. And, so today there's a whole generation of people who don't understand that Muslims are not terrorists and they have been deliberately othered. And
so they're doing it in China too, and that it's a hidden concentration camps in China, right?
They're doing it in Philippines too. They're doing it in Brazil too. There's another everywhere. And in America, what I've noticed this time is there has been a robust fight put up by the Democrats. They have confronted racism and slavery head on.
Yes.
There is a debate in the Senate about the attack on Capitol Hill, which is much more serious than the demolition of the mosque in India. This is Capitol Hill and the president of the country standing inside and saying,
"You're very good people. Go. I love you." That's what he said.
And so, you know, this is very, very dangerous and they have to be held accountable. First of all, this is very important. And the second thing is the counter narrative to whatever QAnon and the Republicans and the Proud Boys are doing about the sidelined majority or, you know, making people believe that they are being victimized when they are not. A counter narrative on racism has to be very, very much shared with as many people as possible in as many ways as possible with as many generations as possible. Because otherwise people, white folk are feeling threatened and somebody has to give them the right facts.
Yeah. Yeah. You could see how they were whittling away, especially in the last 4 years, everything that was helping humanity. I don't understand how these people, the QAnon people or the Trump supporters even feel like, what has he done for their lives? Like nothing. He did nothing to make their lives better. I don't understand why that they're so devoted to him.
Well, they've always been the rage, and Trump has tapped into that rage, and so has QAnon tapped into that rage and directed it towards black people. You know, like you remember when in Charlottesville there was the attack.
Yeah, and he said very nice people on both, very good people on both sides. That's what he did. That's what prompted Biden to come out, which was amazing.
Exactly. And so
he said no.
Very, very good, because he's confronting it. The impeachment trials are an education for all of America. And we need to educate. We just have 2 years, really. And in the 2 years, if we do not recapture lost ground, things are going to be very tough. That's the thing I can tell you from India. Because once they get into the government, they actually use the state machinery. And then what will be at stake is democracy.
I think we're seeing it. We're seeing it in real time. It just what happened the other day. The fact that they, you know, didn't think that he had anything to do with the insurgent, like this crazy failed coup.
Exactly.
And he did. It had everything to do with it.
Telling us, you know, just like Modi used to say, make India great again, shining India. And Trump says, make America great again. And, you know, they speak very clearly about what they want and they go ahead and do it. And we think it's not possible. And by the time we react, they've already done it. He has already announced, Trump has already said that his impeachment trials were actually the beginning of his election campaign. We have to understand that very carefully, that what he's saying, that he's going to polarize, he's going to organize more flashpoints between black and white people, and he will polarize. So we have to give the counter argument to the polarization.
And so I think it's if it wasn't for COVID, we'd be all on the streets every day, like the farmers in India. I mean, we would be on strike. We'd be on the streets. I would. I know you would.
I would. It's now or never. It's really now or never, because if democracy in America goes, then the whole world loses, right?
Right. And you're right. So it's organizing. It's coming together. I do like this group, Refuse Fascism, and now there are many, many more groups. I think there's a group in New York City. Refusing. I forgot what it's called, but Refuse Racism and Fascism of New York City. They're doing a lot of work, and so it's just coming together. Everybody how fragile our democracy really is, and hanging on to it. And it's going to take all of us coming together to make sure that we can breathe, that we can literally breathe.
Exactly.
Because that's, I mean, I think because what the world witnessed with George Floyd, his murder for minutes and 45 seconds, and the world saw that, and that happens every day around our country without anybody filming it or seeing it, and that we all were witness to that, which, you know, spurred this movement in a way that we had never seen before. I mean, of course, Black Lives Matter was always there, but it came to the forefront. And I was there. I was on some of the protests. Like, it was peaceful. It was beautiful. And it wasn't Black Lives Matter that started the violence. It was white supremacy, like putting bricks up and maybe, you know, a few people like paid people to like break a window. I mean, but there was no violence coming from the Black Lives Matter movement this summer. There wasn't.
That's the whole thing, you know, Rosanna, is that, you know, how a lie can become the truth to the millions of people that they spread their messages to. And, you know, internet and all the algorithms that they have through artificial intelligence have been working for them. And there is absolutely no regulation of spreading this hate and this lies. And something you're asking me, what can be done? I think we need regulated media. I know a lot of people say that free speech is important, but free speech has to have boundaries. The most important
hate speech is not free speech. Free speech shouldn't be hate speech. Like hate speech that creates, that's not freedom. Hate speech is not freedom.
And, you know, Gandhi writes in his Experiments of Truth he says he wanted to figure out this idea of freedom of speech, and he's walking on the street and another man was walking towards him, and that man was swinging his hands. And Gandhi told him that this was in London. And he said, please don't swing your arms like that. It's going to hurt my nose. And so the man said, I have the freedom to do what I want with my body. And Gandhi said, your freedom ends where my nose begins.
Yes. And that's it. So, yeah, and that's gotten because of the internet, because of the Twitter, the social media, the new platforms like the Parlors, which are all basically fund and create for hate speech and disinformation. It's terrifying.
You know, old-fashioned journalism, that's why. Because, you know, in the old-fashioned newspapers, like, you know, there was an editor, there was an editorial team. They would fact-check, and only then things would get into the paper. Now with Facebook and Twitter and all of that, anybody can post.
Oh, how about Fox News? Fox News, I always felt like... Did Putin make a deal with Murdoch? Like, what's the deal here? Because this is just state TV, and they just constantly are brainwashing half of the country that believe this shit. It's terrifying.
It is terrifying. It is terrifying how easily people want to believe lies.
And then you think, like, how are they believe? Like, why? How do they get away with it? All these sponsors, and I've been saying it on in my Twitter, like, boycott. We have to really be serious. Maybe we're going to lose our cable. I mean, but Fox News is frightening what they're doing.
I think,
and they constantly lie. Like, and so many big companies that we use, people like, you know, big movie studios, all these are fund them and give them money. We have to boycott.
Absolutely. And that's an action point. So we have to think about these kind of action points and maybe make a list of 10, which can be very critical pivots to do something, because really we are fighting to breathe, as you said. In the past, people fought not to be cooked, literally, in Auschwitz, and now we are fighting to breathe.
Speaking of that, I mean, we have our own concentration camp that, you know, everybody's, not everybody, but that's, you know, at the border, and what he did with the children, and you know what was going on there, that they took breastfeeding babies away from their mothers and locked them up in the most horrible cages and without anything, without food and medicine. They would not let doctors down there. Dr. Astrid Hager wanted to go there with a group of doctors. They would not let any doctors in. It's just like, and this, I know Biden's, you know, working on that, but it's terrifying. We're trying to reunite, you know, the kids, but I think a lot of people disappeared, and I feel, and I don't know, but I've there's a lot of missing kids. Where did those kids go? I mean, we know, you know the horrors of
the communities of kids who have been separated from the parents and nobody's watching out for them. One of the things is sexual predators, right?
Yes. So they've sold the, I feel like a lot of them may have ended up in trafficking. And then from there, this is really horrific, scary. Will people be angry that I say something like this? But we know that there's also organ trafficking that makes millions and millions of dollars. Like some of these disappeared people, they sell their organs.
I know there's a lot of sale of kidneys and cornea, and there are these clinics which do illegal operations. There are apartments where these women are kept till they're operated on. Many of them are illegal migrants. Others are victims.
They did hysterectomies. They did hysterectomies on migrant women.
And victims which of trafficking.
Yes. Yeah.
As you said, so detention camps on the border are almost like cages, and children are separated. I'm working on a book on a little girl who died in near the Arizona desert. Her father was a taxi driver in New York, a migrant from India, and he had left home when his daughter was 6 months old. And they kept trying for a visa. And during the Trump administration, of course, the wife and daughter could not get a visa in spite of all the family reunification ideals. Oh, they paid a smuggler to take them across the Mexican border near Arizona, and the child got separated from the mother looking for water, and the border guards found her dead, dehydrated. And, you know, there are stories and stories like this, heart-wrenching, mother-daughter separated, children stuffed into detention camps, and now, you know, it's going to be hard to trace their parents. How many of them, and all this was outsourced to private profit-making prison companies. And, you know, God knows how many of those children were sold by guards inside those companies, because nobody was going to come and look for them. And now, you know, Biden is trying to trace their parents. It's going to be so hard to find the child, find the parent. Those years will never come back.
But you have seen some miracles in the work that you do with helping girls get an education, sending them to college, and having a healing in your circle, the healing circles. There's healing that can come from this, from the work that you've done in APNEAP, which I have always felt is like, you know, God's work, I got to tell you.
So, you know, there is a healing, and, you know, of course, the failures are many more than the successes, because the situation is so grim. And I'm dealing with both organized crime and intense trauma, because it is a body invasion. And repeated body invasion, as male prisoners will tell you, is the worst thing which can happen to people. And there is higher rates of PTSD among victims of trafficking than even returning war vets, right?
Yes.
So, you know, of course, I cannot help so many people recover. But then I thought, I'm going to, and this is from Gloria Steinem, I learned this. She always said that do what you can. Don't think about what you can do. Don't wait for the perfect, but do what you can. Yeah. Because only time will show whether something you did was big or small. And that has been true really in my own work, because it all was very daunting. It seemed so overwhelming, you know, a child trapped in a brothel, trafficked across thousands of kilometers, important people, politicians, border guards, prison companies, all of them involved. You know, who was I, a journalist who'd even given up a job to stand up to them? And yet, you know, I succeeded with a few girls. I managed to shut down a red light area in India forever. And so that community will never have to face this destiny again. The women who started APNEAP with me, who wanted to save their daughters from prostitution, their daughters have finished school and have got jobs, and they're helping their mothers now get out of the red light area by living with them. So there is a possibility. And also, you know, the friends and allies I found as I went along doing my work, you know, how unlikely is it that you and I should be talking? I'm from India, from Calcutta, and you're from Los Angeles in America.
Oh, New York originally, but yeah, I live in LA now. I'm definitely a New Yorker.
You and I are laughing together. You know, how unlikely is this moment? You know, it wouldn't have happened if you were not an activist and I was not an activist. Yeah. There are different commonalities. And there's a family of birth and a family of choice. And I found that family of choice. How unlikely is it that an Indian girl would speak to the US Senate for a change in the law, to create a law, the first Trafficking Victim Protection Act? I went and testified in the Senate for that. Or, you know, speak at the UN. You know, I'm not.
And did you get that law passed?
Yes, I did. It was the first Trafficking Victim Protection Act of the United States.
Yes.
And
amazing.
It was just like I was a documentary filmmaker in India and ended up doing that. So, or meeting Gloria Steinem, who was from a different generation, again, a different continent. And, you know, one of my closest friends. And I don't even, you know, even the word friend seems.
Soul sister.
Soul sister is a good one.
As
I can get. And, you know, my friendship with her has been an adventure. Because we don't have a sense of borders and boundaries at all, you know. So it's hard for us to say we are from different countries or different cultures or anything. It's all merged into one desire for a world in which no human being is bought or sold. President Clinton, you know, so many people I've met along the way, and some of them have fallen by the wayside. Some have been caught in their own vulnerabilities after doing some good. And I've also realized that nobody is perfect in the work. But we all are flawed, and we should not demand perfection of our own, you know, and nothing from our enemies, because the enemies are greater, the organized criminals, the traffickers, the pimps, the brothel keepers. And we have to stand united and
not turn on our own, because I've noticed within just even little groups of doing the same work, and yet they have this ego competitive thing, which is very dangerous. Like, how about joining hands and joining forces? And then you're so much stronger. I just had this conversation with people, you know, the anti-fascist people that are out there working, and there's a few groups, and they need, I said, come together, meet with each other and join forces. You're saying the same message. And that's what I get really nervous when people have ownership on their thing. And I understand, you know, that's a danger zone. And we've all fallen into that. But it's like, I know for myself, having even experienced it a little bit in my own life, like, no, that's not okay. It doesn't work. We're all one. We join forces and we all want the same outcome.
And you realize that, Rosanna, when you sparked the Me Too movement and stood by the side to let others be the faces more than you, you did give your voice. You didn't shirk the courage it required to be able to speak up, because, you know, there is a repercussion in Hollywood and the industry. But you did.
It certainly was for me, that's for sure. But, you know, it's interesting because I remember, you know, in that time there was like a lot, there was a lot of women who weren't movie stars and had this same experience, and their careers were ruined. But of course, like, the press would come to me, or they wanted to talk to me, or Ashley, or, you know, Mira, and that was kind of like, I got to a point where it was like, you know, I don't need to do that. And here, speak to this, give it to them, you know? And so that a lot of the women, you know, have really become real activists in their life because of this. And it's a good thing. But yeah, what I was happy about with all of that was the work that Tarana Burke had done for all these years, and that it elevated her work, because she started the Me Too movement years and years ago, and it just her phrase was sparked by I guess Alyssa Milano putting, you know, saying that, and it was her work that she had done for years and years, and so that now she is, like, you know, she is the leader of the Me Too movement for sure is Tarana Burke, and so to be a part of elevating her great work and all of that is a good thing.
Exactly. So. And so you created a movement by making sure that other people had voices and amplifying it and stepping out of the way when required and stepping in when required. So, you know, I've long admired you for that. And I also remember, you know, when you hosted something for me in your home where I spoke about sex trafficking to a group in Hollywood.
And again, so we brought in some of the because people didn't know your work at that point, and now everybody does in this town, I would say. But some real, you know, the powerhouse women that were able to write a check and help your work. One of the first, you know, we had this beautiful luncheon, and you were able to speak and got some wonderful people involved, like Sybil Robson Orr, you know, came to India, and we helped put somebody, you know, a girl named T. Ortiz, who was a traffic girl walker through college, that I met when you guys were speaking together. And then we went to the UN, and I saw her speak at the UN too. And I think you and I and Sybil helped put her through college.
Yeah, T. Rosanna T. has graduated through college, and now she's in Hawaii with a husband.
And she got married. I know, I love it.
Just had a baby too.
Oh, how is she? I gotta speak to her. Because I saw her on the thing and then missed out. So I wanna connect with her. So she's happy. She's doing okay now.
Yes.
So happy. Good. 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 So that's a success story of what APNEAP does, because we, through APNEAP, helped to put this woman who had been trafficked since she was 4 years old for a bag of heroin from her own mother, sold her for a bag of heroin. And she is one of the great speakers herself on sex trafficking. And to hear that she has this a good story right now is beautiful. But that's some of the work that you do, is put them through school and have a happy beginning. Let's say happy beginning.
Yes, we've broken the cycle for sure, because, you know, I was just doing a count of how many girls have I been able to put through college, because I was feeling a little low with all these arrests of journalists. I was a journalist, and I was thinking, you know, nothing can be done. And I said, okay, let me count on what good things have happened. And I started with the girls. And it's 2,041 girls that I put through college who were born in the brothels.
Oh.
Their mothers were prostituted, and they have been able to finish college. So it's a good feeling. If we think person by person, and if we think moment by moment, then, you know, instead of getting daunted and overwhelmed, we'll do it. Also, the other thing, you know, is especially when we are dealing with fascism and dealing with misogyny in the middle of fascism and sex trafficking inside misogyny, it's all layers of the same thing. The other thing is that, you know, instead of looking it up for the leader to come from somewhere and help us, if we look at each other, we can succeed.
Yes.
And that's what we did. So, you know, you and I met in this very unlikely fashion. But then we went and helped T. And there's one person who's finished college because of this cross-country, cross-culture, cross-friendship,
yes.
Right? So we did what we could. We didn't think, oh my God, we'll have to wait for everyone to begin to think like us. That will come.
And everybody, if everybody just even takes on, like, helps within their own community, one person, like, it's just everybody daily helping somebody. It's good energy. It's a chain reaction, and it helps. It grows into something beautiful, and that's what I hope we continue to do in this world right now. I get so scared because I have a 26-year-old daughter who, you know, because you honored her, and one of your APNEAP honored her for what was the award that she got? The last girl.
Award.
And she read that poetry, her poetry in that room, and I was just so blown away. But just this generation now of girls that are coming up, like, what is this world? Like, they look at the world right now, and it's daunting and depressing, and there's a darkness to it. And that we, like, to leave this world for my kid and her kids, I hope we're going to, like, every day is just about, you know, obliterating fascism in every way, shape, or form. That's what we have to do.
And, you know, that's exactly, you're right to fear for the kids, because, you know, we had a community when growing up. So we got used to building friendships. We grew up at a time when, you know, it was possible to form friendships and not feel alienated. And right now, fascism breaks down relationships, right? It kills empathy. And,
yeah.
One of the things it does in, you know, eroticizing violence is it teaches me to hate you, but it also teaches me not to empathize. Even if I begin to feel empathetic, it'll cut it off. And they use pornography to do that. And, you know, so basically, kids are so alienated from each other that it's hard.
And the COVID thing, the whole COVID of having to be isolated within our homes and then the access to the computer more, it's almost feel like, what is really going on here? Like, did they purposely do this? Is there, there's something so horrendous and ominous and dark about it that it's just,
so
it created more of a disconnect where we're not allowed to even hug or touch each other. I mean, it's a real disease that's killed very many people. And now we've got this vaccine.
And, you know,
fighting about
growing up in front of computers who talk. You know, I met my niece's twins and I saw that they had a hard time talking because they've lost the ability to talk in these last 6 months. They're only 10, 12, you know, and all the time sitting in front of computers. They have no companions. So it's going to be a very, very tough time. We won't understand the five senses. And that is why, you know, when you think about Zoe, she's growing up in this world. So how is she going to find the companionship, the friendship, the community that she needs? Where are the five senses? And I think one of those things will be her poetry. It's really powerful. And
she's doing this ballet that is so extraordinary. I won't give away the costume that she created. That's just, I've never seen anything like it. I mean, I know it's like my kid and you're talking, it's like my kids are genius, but she is really brilliant on so many levels. And I'm really proud of her because she's also walked through the fire in her own stuff. And that's her own story, but she talks about it in her poetry, where she came from to get to this place where she's able to use her creativity to heal. And so I'm really excited about her future and the life that she could have. And I know that, you know, a lot of these kids are just surviving right now, but like you're right about the young kids in front of the computer. What I've noticed is that the educators now need to figure this out because they're doing it in the way they used to do it when you're in a classroom and they have to change. And do this, if we're going to be in, kids are going to be more online schooling, and they're going to have to figure out a way to, you know, take breaks. A lot of the kids are actually, you know, on their phones the whole time, you know, pretending they're like, you can't regulate them. And so and there's a huge depression that's coming from young people, more suicides than we've ever seen. I mean, this is chronically a danger zone, you know, of what's happening. And I think that, I hope that educators themselves can find a way to do this in a more humane way for the kids.
Absolutely. You know, and also, like, you know, how are the kids? The kids will have to figure out everything themselves. Sometimes I feel, you know, I have this campaign called Girls for the Last Girl. And the reason I started that campaign was, of course, in LA in the Crossroads School, with four of your friends' children, if you remember, Mamie Dillon and Lucy Rice and Abby. And so basically, I was trying to build empathy by doing that, where a girl from the first world of privilege would be able to connect with a girl from a brothel and understand that while, you know, the birth lottery had put them in different positions, their dreams, their hopes and their aspirations were the same. So I think what educators have to do is reconnect. We have to figure out how to rebuild connections as we build back better. And rather, because this new fascism wave is going to try to divide us. And we have to see how can we connect all the time and build empathy. So anything which cuts off empathy, we should remove from our life. If porn cuts off empathy, we should remove it from our life. We have to be really careful about that.
You and I are like empaths. So it's I found that.
But Rose,
more than
you and I had not met in person, do you think we would have formed the same level of friendship?
No, not. I mean, maybe. No, because it was our connection, seeing each other and our feeling each other, connecting in the eyes and just being next to each other energetically, that we understood each other. So no. I think it's harder to, if we just met like this, I would say, yes, I love you, you're a lovely human being, but I know you more who you are by spending time with you, by eating Indian food at your, prepared at your home.
You know, there's something more to sharing moments, and which is osmosis.
Yeah. Yeah. Explain to me just, you know, what does Apni App do?
Apni App works to end sex trafficking by going inside brothels, inside red light areas, and helping the daughters of prostituted women get into school and organizing the women in prostitution to access their basic needs and human rights by going to court or by getting an ID card if they're undocumented, by getting some training to start a new business, and also filing cases against traffickers.
Great. This is an important, great work. And where can people go to help support Apni App?
We have two websites, and one is called apniapp.org, APNEAAP. Remember, APNEAAP.org. And there are various things you can support, sponsorship for children in schools, or for a woman to get a new job training, or to file a case against a trafficker. Or you can go to 1millionmeals.org, which is our food drive for victims of sex trafficking during COVID.
Great. I'm going to also do, I'll do that myself too, and put it out there. I'll also redo that. So we'll have both. I love you, Ruchira. I'd love to see you soon. I got to get my, when I get to New York, which I miss.
Me too. I'm so longing to meet people in person now.
Yes. Well, you come out here too would be great.
I would love to. You know, what I want to do is do a cross country, and I want to go to all the civil rights sites. As soon as I get a vaccine, that's what I'm going to do.
Okay. Now, you've already had COVID, so is it okay to, you're supposed to get a vaccine even though you've had it?
I'm waiting for my cancer doctor to tell me.
Because, yes.
He can
We didn't talk about that also. That's part two, but you're also a cancer survivor. And I did see you walk through that. And I can't believe I didn't ask about that, because I just remember you going through a lot of things, you know, like a cancer treatment, a mastectomy, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And then still doing your work, still out there doing the work and never complaining.
Yeah. That's one thing, hope that life,
yeah.
You know, life is so precious and it's so worth living. And I realized that after cancer more so, you know, when I walked out of Sloan Kettering, and it was a fall evening in New York, and I could move my arm freely because I'd lost a breast, and I felt so free in that moment with the twinkling lights of the towers, the twilight in the sky over Central Park, and a yellow cab, you know, going past. I really felt complete. And I think it was, you know, so many levels of lives going on around me that made me believe once again that life is so beautiful.
Well, you're so beautiful. And thank you so much for being on this planet, Ruchira. You're one of the Avatar angels. Thank you.
Thank you, Rosanna.
Okay. I'll talk to you soon, okay, huh?
Bye.
Okay, lots of love. Bye. Bye. Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening. Be sure to rate and review Radical Musings to help other listeners find the show. And subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast to be alerted every time we post a new episode. Radical Musings is brought to you by Audio Up, produced by Krista Liney and Carla Braun. Edited by Jeremiah Zimmerman. Production support provided by Ashley Ardent, Sam Winter, Tyler Dorson, Emma Rappold, and Richard Regal. Thank you all so much.
Hi, I've got a prescription for diabetes test strips. How much is the copay?
That could take me a while to calculate. In the meantime, you should think about over-the-counter ContourNext test strips. You get 35 for $19.99, and they're highly accurate. For full details, visit ContourNext.com/radio.
Now is the chance to use reliable energy to grow your money with the Dominion Energy Reliability Investment. Our new investment product offers competitive returns, no maintenance fees, and flexible online access to your money. Make the reliable investment in reliable energy. The Dominion Energy Reliability Investment. To find out more, go online to reliabilityinvestment.com. That's reliabilityinvestment.com.